4 p.m. However, only those with an order from their primary care physician will be tested. People must have symptoms in order to be tested. Over 30 people were tested on Tuesday, but according to Love, receiving results again will take some time, as we just mentioned.
This is something that we've been trying to provide for our community and our patients for a while. So this is not a rapid, you drive in, we swab you, we tell you right away kind of thing, or even call you later in that day. This is going to take a little while. So we still provide patients with guidance in terms of quarantining themselves empirically until we have an answer, making sure that if this does end up being COVID, we're not exposing other people to that patient in the meantime.
Symptoms for coronavirus include a fever as well as lower respiratory distress. If you have any questions, of course, see your doctor. A couple of other stories just to pass along before we get into Dave's show here. Butler Township is closing their municipal building to walk-in service. Butler County Community College is canceling or moving to remote instruction. Central Electric Cooperative is restricting access to their office and lobby area in Parker to maintain health for their workers and the public as well. All Butler County senior centers are closed. The Area Agency on Aging is offering free meals to anyone over the age of 60 who is in need. If you're interested in receiving a meal, you can call their office at 724-282-3008. And local school districts are continuing to help their communities as well. South Butler Superintendent Dr. David Foley said about 75 students were provided meals to their households, to the students. According to Monitaw Superintendent, his district is also providing free meals as well. And we told you yesterday about the Butler Area School District. All these stories and more can be found on our website at butlerradio.com. WISR News Time is just about 12:32. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back after that with Dave Malarkey and It's Your Turn. It's 12:32 with WISR 680 AM.
The Butler Agway, brand you trust and people you know. So much more than just a tagline. At Butler Agway, you'll find the perfect feed for your dog, cats, chickens, cows, horses, even the birds. All made here in the good old USA. Hi, this is Mike Lang, and when you're in Butler, a stop at Butler Agway is a must. Whether it's lawn and garden, a gift for my favorite gardener, patio furniture, or feed for those backyard birds. I know the good people at Butler Agway will help me make the right selection. Not only that, they'll even load it in my vehicle for me and have me smiling like a butcher's dog. Butler Agway, Route 68, just west of Butler.
WISR News Time is just about 12:33. Again, a quick look at your weather. You'll have some rain showers off and on, not only today, but Thursday and Friday as well. Once we get to the weekend, we'll have a lot of sunshine on our hands. For temperatures, a high today of 55, tomorrow 67, Friday 69, Saturday 41. Again, your news time, 12:33. I'm Tracy Morgan in the Next Tier Bank studios. Next Tier Bank, your hometown community bank. Dave Malarkey's up next with It's Your Turn. Thanks for joining us, and do have a good day.
And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Hello there. Good afternoon. Welcome. Nice to be with us on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. We are going to be talking about Parkinson's disease on the first portion of the program today. And we'll be chatting with a physician, Dr. Ray Dorsey, about that in just a moment or so. A couple of quick announcements and program notes here today. As I told you yesterday, due to our current situation, we have eliminated any live guests coming into our talk studio over the next couple of weeks at least. We have endeavored to schedule some telephone interviews. Even those are becoming more difficult as more and more people are not at their workplace. We've also here at the radio stations instituted a no visitors policy, and that is in effect today. And our management has decided that it would be prudent for the senior members of our staff to self-isolate. So we are going to begin that tomorrow. The senior members of our staff, among those most vulnerable to COVID-19. So we are going to let some of our junior members who are less vulnerable to carry the ball here for a while. And obviously how long, we don't know. But just to let you know about that, starting tomorrow, some of the senior members of our staff here at the Butler Radio Group are going to be self-isolating. Okay, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we chat via telephone, of course, with Dr. Ray Dorsey, MD, about Parkinson's disease. We'll be right back.
The deals at Tobacco for Less just keep getting better and better. Their stores now include a great loyalty program for valued customers that can help you save on your purchases. Each dollar spent at Tobacco for Less will earn a point, and once you hit 200 points, you can redeem $10 off any purchase of $25 or more. Stock up on their various tobacco products, explore the cigar selection in their walk-in humidor, or check out the great CBD products in their health and wellness department. For all your smoking and vaping needs, visit Tobacco for Less in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Going to be talking, listeners, on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. By the way, my name is Dave Malarkey. If you're just joining us, going to be talking about Parkinson's disease. Ray Dorsey is our guest, MD, a doctor, and we're going to be talking about a new book entitled A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. Dr. Dorsey, nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, Dave.
Maybe we should start out by making sure that everyone understands just what Parkinson's disease is. Can you explain it to us in a nutshell?
Sure. So Parkinson's disease is the fastest growing brain disorder in the world, faster than even Alzheimer's disease. It's a disease that's classically characterized by individuals having a tremor, usually in their hands, slowness of movement, difficulties with walking or balance, and stiffness.
Hmm. So that's why this book is very important right now. I didn't realize that Parkinson's was the fastest growing neurological disorder.
Yes, so over the last 25 years, the number of individuals with Parkinson's disease has more than doubled globally to over 6 million. In the coming 25 years, if we don't act, it'll double again. An individual's lifetime risk of developing Parkinson's disease is up to 1 in 15. And over a million Americans and nearly 50,000 people in Pennsylvania have the disease today.
Wow. Faster than Alzheimer's. A lot of folks worry about Alzheimer's because that particular condition, that disease, makes all the headlines. But Parkinson's is growing even more rapidly. I always thought years ago I had an uncle who suffered from Parkinson's disease. He had severe tremors in his hands, and had very difficult walking. In fact, he used a walker as long as I knew him. I did not realize until relatively recently that there can be another component to Parkinson's disease, and that is a dementia component, correct?
Yes, so I told you what the classical features of the disease. There are some features of the disease that develop later in the course, such as dementia, and there are some symptoms that develop very early in the course, loss of smell, constipation, depression, and anxiety. So the disease actually begins decades before the tremor actually appears, usually with loss of smell or constipation or changes in sleep, then develops into the movement features of the disease, tremor, slowness of movement, difficulty walking, and then later cognitive impairment, dementia, and even hallucinations.
So we've talked a little bit about Parkinson's disease, just what it is. There continue to be some myths about Parkinson's disease, though. Can you talk a little bit about those, Dr. Ray Dorsey?
Yes, I think the biggest myth is that Parkinson's disease is not preventable. So Parkinson's disease is, to a large extent, may be preventable. It was first described by Dr. James Parkinson in 1817 in England. At that time, it was almost certainly an extremely rare disorder. He was a 61-year-old physician and wrote about six individuals, three of whom he had never examined, just saw them walking on the streets of London. And he said, at that time, I'm describing something that's not been classified in the medical literature before. Fast forward 200 years, we have the world's fastest growing brain disorder. And so what's happened in the interim is that Parkinson's disease has grown up with products and byproducts of industrial revolution. So numerous studies have linked certain pesticides, air pollution, heavy metals, and certain chemicals to the disease. And as countries use these products and byproducts, their rates of Parkinson's increase.
Mm. So environmental issues are a concern. I did not know that. By the way, I didn't know where the name came from either. I knew that Alzheimer's disease came. There was a German physician, medical researcher named Alzheimer's. I didn't know that there was, he was English, Parkinson?
Yeah, he was English, and he almost got imprisoned for a plot to try to kill King George III. He was a radical in many respects. He was in favor of, at the time, of women's suffrage. He was as a strong advocate for those for the mentally ill. He was definitely a man who was ahead of his time.
Well, this goes back a ways then. George III, wasn't he the king during the American War of Independence?
Yeah, so, you know, King George III had a long reign, so 1817 is about 40 years after the War of Independence.
Mm. So your recommendation in your book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, would be to start taking a more serious look at what we can do environmentally and eliminating some of these things you just described a few moments ago?
Yeah, I think no one wants to develop a debilitating condition for the last 15 years to 20 years of their life. And we all want to prevent that disease from ever occurring. So certain pesticides like paraquat, which has been banned by 32 countries, including China, but its use in the United States has more than doubled over the last decade. There's a chemical called trichloroethylene, widely used in an industry, used in everything from decaffeinating coffee in the 1970s to whiteout to degreasing. It's found in numerous industrial sites throughout Pennsylvania and the United States. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, industry, any specific industries like steel or glass or manufacturing or textiles or anything?
Yeah, so anything that uses it looks to degrease. So automobile parts manufacturers, it was in Silicon Valley, 21 Superfund sites are contaminated with the chemicals used to clean silicon wafers. I found one 15 minutes from my home in Rochester, New York. There are undoubtedly hundreds, if not thousands, throughout western Pennsylvania that are contaminated with this chemical. And I'm sure many of your listeners worked with the chemical. About 8% of workers in England have worked with this chemical. And we highlight in the book stories of individuals who worked with the chemical and later developed Parkinson's disease.
And in terms of some of the pesticides that you described, I suppose farmers would be at risk for that, huh?
Yeah, so farmers are anywhere from 50 to 200% increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease. And it's not just farmers who are at risk for Parkinson's disease, but people who live in rural areas or drink water from wells because the pesticides are sprayed or used on farms, wash off the farms, contaminate groundwater. 40 million Americans get their water from private wells, not from municipal water. And those private wells aren't subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act and are rarely tested, so many individuals are drinking or have drunk when they were a teenager or even a child water from wells that are contaminated with these pesticides, many of which are nerve toxins, which target the same nerve cells that are damaged in Parkinson's disease.
A little bit about our guest listeners. Ray Dorsey is the David M. Levy Professor of Neurology at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Center for Health and Technology. There are three other co-writers who joined you in writing this book, Ending Parkinson's Disease. One of them, Todd Shearer, and Dr. Dorsey, he's the guy really who found this link between pesticides and Parkinson's, right?
Exactly right. So Dr. Shearer is actually the CEO of the Michael J. Fox Foundation, but when he was a young neuroscientist, he and his colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh, Dr. Tim Greenemeyer, identified that chronic exposure to a pesticide called rotenone causes Parkinson's disease in mice. And that was a huge breakthrough in our understanding of the disease and has fueled our fueled efforts to help prevent the disease. Unfortunately, we in the United States have been unable or unwilling to take action to ban pesticides, for example, that 32 other countries have.
Speaking of Michael J. Fox, it was some years ago that he announced that he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's. I don't know whether Michael J. Fox is still working. I've seen him on TV not too long ago.
Yeah, he's still working, and since he's so Parkinson's disease is far from a death sentence, so since Mr. Fox has developed Parkinson's disease, he's written three books. I think one's coming out in the fall. He starred on numerous TV shows and is the founder and co-founder of the Michael J. Fox Foundation, which is the largest private foundation for Parkinson's research in the world.
At Armco Credit Union, their top priority is the health of members and employees. Effective today, their lobby is closed, but they're still open for business. Please use their drive-through, online banking, mobile banking, and teller phone services. You may also call their call center at 724-284-2020 during regular business hours. They'll also announce extended hours for the drive-through and call center next week. Please visit armcocu.com for updated information. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and federally insured by NCUA.
Welcome, listeners. It's nice to have you with us on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest, Dr. Ray Dorsey, MD, medical doctor, joins us by telephone. He's one of the authors of a new book entitled A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. What about the treatment for Parkinson's, doctor? Can you talk about some of the treatments that are being used or being researched?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease is a highly treatable condition. The first thing people should know about it is that exercise can not only help individuals with Parkinson's disease, but also goes decrease your risk of ever developing the condition. So if you do vigorous exercise in your 40s and 50s, you can decrease your risk of developing Parkinson's disease in your 60s and 70s by 20%. And numerous studies have demonstrated that exercise for individuals with the condition is beneficial. Everything from bicycling to Tai Chi to running to even tango have been studied and demonstrated to have benefits in individuals. So I routinely recommend that individuals exercise at least an hour a day. In addition, there's a highly effective medication for Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's disease is due to a loss of nerve cells in the brain that produce a chemical called dopamine. And there's a medication called levodopa, which is taken by mouth, just a tablet, and it's converted to dopamine. And this can be a miraculous drug medication for many individuals with Parkinson's disease. The challenge is that it doesn't treat the underlying disease itself. It's just treating predominantly the symptoms. And disease, it has its own side effects, which develop over years of use.
You mentioned tremors, especially in the hands. Are there other conditions that would cause these? Does someone who starts to get tremors in the hands, does that automatically mean that they've got Parkinson's?
No, there's another very common condition called essential tremor, which is a tremor when you do an action, such as like putting on mascara, or bringing a glass of water to your mouth, or eating soup from a spoon. But Parkinson's has some key features that differentiate it from essential tremor. Parkinson's is usually a tremor at rest. So the tremor happens when someone's just sitting, resting, or walking often. The tremor is usually asymmetric, worse in one hand than the other, and then is accompanied by other symptoms, everything from loss of smell, constipation, sleep disturbances, to slowness in movement and difficulty walking.
Your book is divided into three different parts. You talk about Parkinson's disease. We kind of looked at that in a cursory manner. And then you have something called the PACT. Can you talk about that, doctor?
So we highlight, as you suggest, the rise of Parkinson's disease, and the second half, the bulk of the book is devoted to what we can do to prevent and end Parkinson's disease, and we put forth a PACT, P-A-C-T, to one, prevent the disease from ever occurring, two, advocating for better policies and resources for the condition, three, care for everyone affected by the disease, and four, treat the condition with novel therapies.
Is your book accessible to a person or a family member of someone who's been diagnosed with Parkinson, or would it be above the heads of the average person?
So the first drafts definitely were above their heads. One of my colleagues says, this is a great idea, but unintelligible. We got it down to a 10th grade reading level, and most of it depicts the stories of people who developed Parkinson's disease or have battled it, everyone from Michael J. Fox to farmers in southwest Michigan who developed Parkinson's disease, to teenagers who worked with trichloroethylene in the auto, in the aerospace industry in Southern California, to advocates who walked around the entire island of Great Britain raising funds for Parkinson's disease. So it's written for everyone with the disease, affected by the disease, and those who never want to develop the disease.
As you mentioned earlier, this is not strictly a disease that affects older people, although in many cases it does. Are CARES treatments for Parkinson's covered by Medicare or no?
Treatments for Parkinson's disease are covered by Medicare, and the vast majority of individuals with Medicare with Parkinson's disease have their insurance through Medicare. One thing we highlight in the book is the need to bring care to patients rather than patients to care. And in the setting of the coronavirus, a lot of attention is being paid to telemedicine. And so I see all my patients over the Internet in their home. And I do that because we should deliver care to patients on their terms instead of asking patients to come see us clinicians on our terms. The challenge is that Medicare doesn't cover that reimbursement for telemedicine. And currently, 40% of Medicare beneficiaries with Parkinson's disease do not see a neurologist. So 40% of people with Parkinson's disease do not see a neurologist soon after diagnosis. And those that do are more likely to fall and fracture their hip, more likely to place in a skilled nursing facility, and more likely to die prematurely. So we need to bring care to everyone affected by the disease.
We have a brand new VA hospital here in our community just north of Pittsburgh, Doctor. And I've talked with some of the folks at VA Healthcare, and they've started a pretty significant telemedicine program. Are there neurologists within the VA, do you know, that could help people with Parkinson's, or would they have to see an outside specialist?
No, the VA has some of the top Parkinson's specialists in the country. I had the fortune to train at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and many of my teachers have worked in the VA and cared for veterans and are some of the top specialists in the country. So the VA actually is well-positioned to do this and an early adopter of the telemedicine. This is especially important for the veterans because many of them were exposed to Agent Orange or DDT or other pesticides that are linked to Parkinson's disease. In addition, veterans are more likely to have sustained head trauma. And many veterans worked with this chemical called trichloroethylene, which is used to decrease auto parts and used in shipping and used with tanks and trucks and vans and buses. So there's at least three major reasons why veterans are at increased risk for Parkinson's disease. And the VA has excellent care programs developed for those individuals. But more importantly, we need to prevent the next generation of veterans from ever developing Parkinson's disease.
I want to talk a little bit more about, in the little time we have left, about some of the symptoms, some of the indicators, obviously tremors, especially in the hands. You mentioned balance problems, difficulty walking. I understand there's also something that could be an indicator of problems with a noticeable change in gait of a person who's walking. They appear to walk sometimes very, very rapidly. Am I correct on that?
Yes. So it's important first that two-thirds of people with Parkinson's disease have a tremor, so there are a third of people with Parkinson's disease who don't have tremor. Almost everyone has a slowness in movement, and people, the vast majority, have troubles walking. Initially, one of the first symptoms is people start walking slower. A man was used to walk faster than his wife and now walks slower than his wife. Later in the disease course, especially untreated, people tend to have a fascination where their feet start moving really, really, really rapidly, and they tend to go faster and faster and going forward and tend to have this propensity to fall forwards. That was actually one of the classic symptoms that Dr. Parkinson described when watching people walk the streets of London in 1817.
One final question, and that has to do with the mental health of people who are battling Parkinson's. Is depression a problem significantly?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease doesn't just affect dopamine in the brain. It affects other chemicals in the brain that are associated with mood, including depression, which 40% of individuals have with Parkinson's disease, anxiety, about 40% of individuals have it, and we think that's part and parcel of the disease, not that you get Parkinson's disease and you're depressed about having Parkinson's disease, but that Parkinson's disease actually causes depression and anxiety. And we talk a lot about the mental health of individuals with Parkinson's disease in the book, but we also share the story of caregivers and the strain and the mental health strain that they experience caring for individuals with Parkinson's disease, including one caregiver who was a physician and nearly committed suicide over his inability to care and support his wife adequately, at least in his eyes. So we know it's a huge issue for those with the disease and for those who care for people affected by the disease.
Listeners, this is a pretty thorough and exhaustive look at Parkinson's. If you or someone in your family is battling this disease, you would be interested. Again, the title is Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. Four individuals have been involved in writing this book. One of them, Dr. Ray Dorsey, MD. He's been our guest. Dr. Dorsey, thanks so much for explaining this to us in terms that we could understand. We appreciate you being with us today.
My pleasure, and if I can be of resource to you or to your listeners, I'm happy to do so. We have a website called endingpd.org that has additional information about the book and ordering it, and you can also just email us at info@endingpd.org with any questions that you have.
Ending Parkinson's Disease, Ending PD. That should be pretty easy to remember. Again, Doctor, thanks so much, sir.
Thank you.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. I'm sure parents would love to have a book to help keep their kids occupied in a productive way, either during the summertime or during times when schools are closed. Well, we've got one. It's from National Geographic Kids. It's called Solve This Forensics, and one of the co-authors is Kate Messner. She visits with us by telephone here on It's Your Turn right now. Kate, tell us a little bit about this book, if you would, please.
Absolutely. So, Solve This Forensics, Super Science and Curious Capers for the Daring Detective in You, is a book that I co-authored with my sister, Ann Rupert, who is a retired high school science teacher. She taught biology and chemistry and forensic science for 20 years in the Buffalo, New York area. And this was a project we came up with over Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house. We were talking about science books for kids and how fascinating forensics can be, because forensic science incorporates so many other branches of science, everything from biology and chemistry with toxicology to anthropology and entomology even, and botany. And so we were talking about this, and it's interesting. There are a lot of popular TV shows about forensics, but many of them are really geared at adults. They deal with, you know, DNA analysis as it relates to some pretty grisly crimes, mostly murders. And so our challenge in creating this book was to come up with some mini mysteries that were gentler and very kid-friendly, but where kids could still learn all those same kinds of science. So in our book, for example, kids explore DNA analysis not through investigating a murder scene, but through investigating a burglary scene where somebody broke into a greenhouse to steal a rare plant and cut themselves in the process. So maybe there was some blood left behind that way. And that allows us to still talk about all those fascinating parts of forensic science, but with crimes that are a little bit more kid-friendly.
Well, adults eat up these crime shows like CSI and some other ones, NCIS. kids love it too, and I think they'll eat up this book. I love the way that you've geared it for younger. Do you have a specific age range that you're targeting here, Kate?
Yeah, Solve This Forensics is probably going to be best for readers ages 9 to 13 or so. It does get into some really great in-depth science, and I think that's going to be fantastic right now. Of course, when we were writing this book starting a couple years ago, we had no idea about the world that it would be released into and that so many families would be learning from home right now. So we really hope it's going to be helpful to those who are in that situation.
Mm-hmm. You start out with, I've got a review copy of the book in front of me right now. You start out with an introduction to the various branches of science, and you talk about those, whether it's chemistry or biology or whatever, right?
Yeah, I mean, our goal here was to introduce a lot of science concepts in a way that was very kid-friendly and engaging, and to be honest with you, feels more like fun and a game that they're figuring out than a textbook. And so we give a lot of background on different branches of science, you know, because forensic science involves so many of those. And then the book goes on to explain all the different types of forensic evidence, everything from blood evidence and DNA and fingerprints to handwriting analysis, insect evidence, shoe prints, toxicology, tool marks, and, you know, computer forensics, too.
And it's hands-on. For example, when you're talking about shoe prints, there's a section in there on how kids can make a plaster cast of a footprint, right? Just like the detectives do on TV.
Yeah, all the different mysteries kind of put kids in the role of the forensic investigator. And they say, okay, if you were doing this, now you would make a plaster cast of the shoe print or photograph it and run it through the database. And then there are also some hands-on activities that families can do right at home. And those are the sections of the book labeled Try This, where kids can actually do forensic science with stuff you already have right in the kitchen. There's a dusting for fingerprints activity, for example, and all you need is some cinnamon, some scotch tape, an index card, and a little makeup brush. And kids can do the same kind of science that investigators do in the field. But with cinnamon, it probably smells better, too.
Yeah. Well, they don't analyze fingerprints the way they used to back in the old days, though, with a magnifying glass.
No, they have great databases now, and kids get to read all about that. Our kids are so computer savvy that I think they're really going to take to those parts of the book, too.
This, of course, comes from National Geographic, so parents can count on the fact that this book is going to be extremely educational. That's quite a reputation they have, National Geographic, of course, right?
They sure do. And I'll tell you, the other thing with National Geographic books for kids is they're so bright and visual and engaging. This book, you know, we wrote the text for it, and then the National Geographic design team did just an amazing job with illustrations and photographs and graphics. They even, for the Try This at Home experiments that families can do together, they did all the experiments at National Geographic and photographed every step, so they're really easy to follow and engaging.
And they're all in brilliant color, too. There are hundreds and hundreds of color photographs. It's a good book for kids, folks. The title is Solve This Forensics from National Geographic Kids. One of the co-authors is Kate Messner, and we've been chatting with her here for a few minutes on It's Your Turn. Your book is just out, right, Kate? It's available already?
Yeah, just out this week.
Terrific. Hey, nice to talk with you. This is a good book. Thanks for being with us.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
And you. Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. I'd like to talk to you for just a moment here about the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. What a great job they do to help those who are less fortunate in many ways. They operate the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, of course. They have their St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart and their Client Aid Program. And the Client Aid Program helps needy families or individuals, you know, maybe with help on a heating bill or a rent payment at the end of the month, Client Aid. And that's funded through the operation of the thrift store. So you can help by donating items that you no longer need or want to the thrift store. It's very easy to do. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. You can use the container outside. They're located in the Greater Butler Mart. So think about it. Next time you're cleaning the closet or the upstairs, instead of throwing that stuff away, why not donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler? We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Going to be talking with a noted environmentalist on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Listeners, my name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest who joins us by telephone is Maya Van Rossum. And we're going to be talking about her recently published book entitled The Green Amendment. Maya Van Rossum, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are suggesting, if I'm able to kind of condense your book down to just a couple of sentences, you are suggesting that instead of relying on state and federal environmental laws, we should try a different tack. We should try adding an amendment to the state constitution. Is that kind of your book in a nutshell, Maya?
Yes, it is. I really talk about how our current system of state and federal environmental protection laws, while having an important role in environmental protection, when you look at it big picture, fundamentally, they are failing us because they focus more on managing pollution, the who, the when, the where, the how of pollution and environmental degradation, as opposed to prevention. Here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we have a constitutional right in the Bill of Rights section of the state constitution to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And while that provision was ignored for its first 42 years, essentially ignored, in 2013, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and seven municipalities brought an important legal challenge that ultimately went up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and restored to the people of Pennsylvania their constitutional right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And that victory really has helped inspire me through this book to try to inspire communities across the nation to follow this same path, because there is only one other state with this constitutional right to a healthy environment. That's Montana. No other state has this important recognition and protection. So we're on the leading edge here in Pennsylvania, and through the book, The Green Amendment, I hope to inspire other states to follow our lead.
You mentioned several decades ago that this was added. I'm trying to search my memory banks for my Pennsylvania history here. There was a constitutional convention held here in Pennsylvania to change our constitution in a number of ways some decades ago. Is that when this was added in, Maya, to the best of your knowledge?
This was actually an independent proposal that was advanced by a very forward-thinking legislator named Franklin Curry. It was proposed in 1971. It had to pass the Pennsylvania legislature twice and then go before the people of Pennsylvania for support. And in fact, when it was proposed, it passed the Pennsylvania legislature in 1971 unanimously. And when it went before the people of Pennsylvania, it passed overwhelmingly by a vote of 4-1. Unfortunately, almost as soon as it was passed, we got some very poor Supreme Court decisions out of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which essentially said that this right to a healthy environment was just good policy, and that this provision did not have the same force and effect of law that all the other provisions in the Bill of Rights of, section of the Pennsylvania State Constitution have. And so largely, for 42 years, largely it remained pretty dormant when it came to environmental protection. It was in 2013 when we restored that legal life, as I like to describe it.
You have been active in trying to protect environmentally the Delaware River Valley. I'm assuming from your Delaware Riverkeeper Network that that's what you've been involved in. Is that right?
Absolutely. I've been the Delaware Riverkeeper and leader of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network since 1994, and so have had a rich experience in environmental advocacy and fighting to protect our environment. And it's through that, all of those decades of work, that it really became so clear to me that our current system of environmental laws has been failing us, when we had the opportunity through litigation to try to restore legal life to Pennsylvania's Green Amendment, and we did so successfully, and as a result, defeated a very provisions in a very pro-fracking piece of legislation, it just became absolutely clear to me that we had this very important, proactive, constitutional path for environmental protection. And so we've continued to fight to strengthen and advance the right to a healthy environment here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, but again also through the book The Green Amendment and all the speaking that I've been doing on the topic, trying to inspire other states to follow Pennsylvania's footsteps on this issue.
Well, here in western Pennsylvania, by the way, listeners, is about 300 miles across. So we're a fur piece from the Delaware River Valley. I can remember, though, Maya, the first time that I vacationed in New England, and I was coming back into Pennsylvania from New England. You crossed that little bit of New York, and then you come down into the Delaware Water Gap. Absolutely sensational. Gorgeous, gorgeous vistas and scenery. Just magnificent. It was the first time that I'd ever experienced that.
Well, I love that you describe our beautiful Delaware River that way, because that certainly is the experience people from around the state, around the nation, and even around the world have when they come to our beautiful upper Delaware. And in fact, the very upper reaches of the Delaware River watershed that are in New York are so well protected environmentally that New York City receives and drinks Delaware River water without going through a drinking water treatment facility. It is actually, they take it and just give it, take it unfiltered to New York City communities, and there it is applauded as the champagne of drinking water in the region and even in the nation. So it really shows how protecting that beautiful upper river watershed really helps protect clean water for the benefit of 17 million people, including the millions living in New York City.
You mentioned that the clean water laws that we have, you contend that they are designed to accommodate pollution rather than prevent it. And really, when you look at the history of the country, those laws are relatively new, right? The clean water and the clean air legislation, that only passed back around 1970 or thereabouts. Am I correct on that?
You are correct. And we have had state laws in Pennsylvania and elsewhere that preceded those, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the National Environmental Policy Act, those laws that people are so aware of and so appreciate. But when you look at all of these laws, what they have in common is that they are focused on issuing permits to people that allow them to pollute and degrade our environment. It really is not illegal to pollute. It's not illegal to fill in a wetland. It's not even illegal to fill in a waterway. You just simply have to go to the right government official and get the right permit in order to do so. And that's part of the problem. So what a constitutional right does is it reorients the focus of decision making and urges and requires decision makers to, in the first instance, work to prevent pollution and prevent degradation. That becomes sort of a primary focus advancing. And then, of course, you will have some pollution and some degradation, but the goal of an environmental rights amendment is to ensure that you protect the constitutional right to clean water, clean air, and a healthy environment. And so we're talking about, you know, vastly different approaches to environmental protection and protecting those, the rights of the people to water, air, and an environment that will benefit them.
So you're urging other states to follow the lead of Pennsylvania? That's one of the purposes of your book, The Green Amendment?
Yes, I'm urging communities in other states across the nation to pass green amendments, and also here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, as well as many other now committed, you know, environmental organizations that have added this body of work to their own palettes. we are all collectively working to really define what it means to have a constitutional right to a healthy environment and making sure that that right is firmly and fully protected at every level of government by every government official here in the Commonwealth.
We have a few more minutes to chat, listeners, with our guest, Maya Van Rossum. A couple of issues I want to bring up with her, but we need to take a quick break. So let's do that, and we'll pick up our conversation with her right after these words.
They have lived a lifetime caring for others, and the time has come for others to care for them. LifeSteps Senior Day Program, a trusted provider for over 30 years, can help. LifeSteps provides a safe, medically monitored environment, providing meals and socialization. Seniors can keep their medical provider while retaining their property and offering respite to family members. Free trial visits are available. Call LifeSteps today at 724-283-1010 or visit lifesteps.net.
Welcome back. If just joining us, my name is Dave Malarkey, and on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR, we're chatting with Maya Van Rossum. She is the author of a book entitled The Green Amendment, Securing Our Right to a Healthy Environment. One chapter in your book, I have a review copy here in front of me, Maya. One chapter caught my eye right away. It was called The Paving of America. And you talk about, particularly if you're flying over the country on a clear day in the western half of the country, you see this this alternating checkerboard pattern so many times. Talk about what that is, because you explained it in your chapter called The Paving of America.
So that really has to do with sort of the history of the railroads here in the United States of America. And, you know, part of the effort to build the railroads that were crisscrossing the country and to give to railroad owners the access and right to land, but at the same time to find ways to protect that land for the benefit of the people. And long story short, what we end up with really is this checkerboard where we have segments of forested and natural landscapes pocked with segments of development. And those once forested landscapes are quickly now being sold off for housing development and real estate development and other kinds of development. And so, one, we already had this piecemeal level of protection for the environment. And really, in order to have a healthy forest, for example, you don't want to have this kind of piecemeal approach to protection, because every cut in the forest landscape not only damages the forest immediately in that cut spot, but it actually damages the neighboring forest areas as well. So you want to look to protect these natural resources in a more cohesive, intact fashion. But also what we see, right, through that checkerboard approach is we see that we create a variety of harms, not just to the forest, but also, and to species that depend on that forest, but also to water quality, and even heighten the threat of wildfires. And so, you know, it becomes a damaging situation environmentally, but also for the health and the safety of the people. And so that's a good example of how thinking about environmental protection proactively on the front end is so vitally important, whether you're talking about forests, waterways, air, stable climate, you know, whatever is your concern. There are proactive, positive ways to do it, but we need to bring that thought process into the front-end decision-making so that we are not, after the fact, reacting to devastating situations that create harm and also require tremendous amounts of money to address, you know, in order to protect the people and protect the environment.
You mentioned in the first part of our conversation, Maya Van Rossum, fracking. I don't know about your end of the state over there near the Delaware River Valley. Here in western Pennsylvania, we're right in the heart of, you know, Marcellus shale country, and there are a lot of landowners here in our immediate area who, you know, who have made quite a bit of money off selling their fracking rights. Does your organization contend that we need to toughen up on fracking regulations?
Yes, and in fact, we go even further than that. We really say that we really need to stop drilling and fracking operations
moving forward in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and in all states where it's happening, and start to instead invest in and advance clean energy strategies. Clean energy strategies can provide us all of the energy we need, and at the same time will protect our environment, will protect our communities, will protect drinking water supplies and property values, and create many more jobs than, in fact, the fracking industry can even pretend to create. But what we're what is happening now with fracking is really, while there may be a few people that can claim that they're getting benefit out of it, so many more communities are suffering as a result, and they are losing their drinking water. They're losing the quality of their air. We all are losing our healthy, stable climate, and so are being subjected, as we can see through recent weather events, to an increasingly unstable climate. People are losing their property values. They are losing jobs that are benefited by a healthy environment. So we have a lot of loss with fracking, but if we get on the clean energy path, we will have a lot of winning, right? We will not only have all of the energy we need, and that has been proven time and time again, but we will also have a healthy environment, healthy communities, healthy economies, and many more jobs.
There are some states that have banned fracking. The last I read, it's not allowed in New York State. Is that still the case, to your knowledge?
That's correct. High-volume hydraulic fracturing is not allowed in the state of New York, and actually in the Delaware River watershed, including the Pennsylvania portion of the watershed, we are currently protected from fracking, and that is why people can come to the beautiful Delaware Water Gap, right, and enjoy a happy, healthy day with their families, recreating, supporting the local economy, and that is why we continue to have healthy drinking water supplies in the Delaware River system, including in, the Pennsylvania communities that feed that system. So here in the Delaware River watershed, what we are showing is that not having fracking is protecting our environment, protecting our communities, and supports a robust economic vitality here in the region, including this portion of Pennsylvania. So we don't want or need fracking in the Delaware River watershed. We don't want or need fracking anywhere, and we are proving that point here in the Delaware River watershed, where we do currently have full protection from the industry. Although I will say, right now, that is at risk. There is a proposal to ban drilling and fracking operations themselves, but to allow the importation for treatment, storage, and disposal of toxic frack wastewater in our watershed, and to allow the watershed to supply water to other communities where fracking is allowed to happen. And so, in a sense, using our beautiful Delaware River watershed, one, sacrificing it to some of the most devastating aspects of the industry, but also allowing our watershed to be used to sacrifice and devastate other communities by supporting fracking happening there. We are opposed to that. We are opposed to drilling and fracking operations in our watershed and in all watersheds, because it is not the right path for the environment, for the people, and it is absolutely not necessary for energy or job creation.
Can you talk a little bit about pipelines, Maya? I know you deal with that in one chapter in your book, pipelines.
Yes, and as a result of this fracking in Pennsylvania, we are now having a massive proliferation of pipelines. And so even communities that aren't being directly fracked, many of them are being indirectly fracked by this expanse of pipeline infrastructure being used or built to pass that gas from central Pennsylvania, western Pennsylvania, to other parts of the country, and frankly, more importantly, to other nations, to other countries, because what the industry has found is they can make more money by selling this dirty fossil fuel overseas than they can by selling it here in the United States of America. And so we have other communities that are being devastated. Properties are being taken through the power of eminent domain that's given to these pipeline companies. They are cutting forests. They are cutting front yards and backyards. They bring with them the potential and the reality of accidents, incidents, and explosions that seriously harm people when they do occur. So it's really, so even those places where you don't have an accident, incident, or explosion happening, you have that ever-present threat, which really takes a toll on the peace of mind of the people who, through the power of eminent domain, have been forced to have these pipelines in their front yards and their backyards where their children play and where they try to relax. What I really like to, you know, make clear to people, there is this false claim by the industry that we need to frack in order to become independent from foreign sources of energy. But the truth is, in just the next few decades, fracked gas is going to be gone. There is not this massive storage of fracked gas under the earth that is retrievable by the industry. And so even the industry itself now acknowledges that in just the next two or three decades, that dirty fossil fuel that is fracked gas, shale gas, will be gone. What that means is that in just a few short decades, we will absolutely, here in the United States of America, be dependent upon foreign sources of energy. But those foreign sources of energy will not be fossil fuels. They will be the clean energy options, the solar panels and the wind technology and the geothermal technology, which is going to be the only true source of energy reasonably available in the near future. So if people want to be energy independent here in the United States of America, we need to get on that clean energy train now, today.
Let me ask you one final question here. Realistically, can we afford a Green Amendment, Maya?
We absolutely can afford the Green Amendment, and and frankly, more importantly, we can't afford not to have a Green Amendment. And I have a whole chapter about that in my book, proving the point that a clean and healthy environment creates money, creates jobs. It also saves money and saves jobs because it saves people from, you know, losing their health to dirty drinking water or to dirty air. You know, the health costs and consequences of a child that has an asthma attack or from people who are getting Alzheimer's or ADHD or other harmful illnesses and effects that result from fracking, even autism, or not fracking, sorry, pollution and environmental degradation, even autism is being linked to pollution, for example. You know, we have these growing flooding and flood problems and flood damages that are so very costly to the families that are impacted, but also to our entire communities. By protecting our environment, we help to avoid many of those flooding events and those flood damages. And again, on the positive side, we create jobs. If you look, just look at the fracking versus clean energy comparison. When you invest in clean energy options, you very literally create, and this has been demonstrated time and time again, 3 to 5 times the number of jobs. And these are enduring jobs, good-paying jobs, long-term jobs. So, you know, we are all better off economically, in terms of our health, in terms of our safety, and in terms of our quality of life, if we protect our environment. If we continue to degrade our environment, then we lose our health, we lose our safety. We have to waste money on responding to flood events and pollution events and replacing, you know, old infrastructure that's creating harm and damage, right? We're just better off making the right investment from the get-go. And so green amendments help us make the right choices on the front end so we can make those better investments that, again, protect our environment, protect our people, and protect our economy at the same time.
She is Maya Van Rossum, the Delaware River Keeper. She advocates passage of green amendments in the Bill of Rights section of every state constitution. And she writes about that in her book, The Green Amendment. Thank you, Maya. Nice to talk with you today. Thanks for spending some time with us.
So great to talk to you, and I really appreciate your helping to spread the good word on this important opportunity and topic.
Sure enough. So long now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way. Getting there stops here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus.
that's what we do. Hop the bus, leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.